Hello, this is Brian Wilson.
Oh, hi, Brian. This is Arnold from Cows Radio in Occidental.
Yes, good morning or good afternoon, I guess.
Well, welcome to Sonoma County and Sebastopol.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm on this bike book tour, so this is, I actually don't think I've ever been in Sebastopol before.
Well, I hope you're enjoying it. It is a gorgeous place.
I am. I kind of have a day off until my book talk tonight.
Now, before we start, perhaps, obviously, a lot has happened to you in your life. Perhaps you can give our listeners a brief description of how you got here. I know you were born in New York and... New York State, rather. And went to, obviously, Vietnam. Can you give us a brief description of the early years, so to speak?
Well, I'll try to be very brief.
Okay.
I grew up in a fairly typical late 40s, 50s home of parents who were very into the McCarthy period, very supportive of the McCarthy period. Mm. It was a rural town, a farming community. I was, you know, a good student, a good athlete. I was a church boy. I was a Boy Scout. Went on to college. Was a little unclear what I was going to do in my life, but I toyed with being an FBI agent and then being a Baptist minister.
Is that very far apart, or are they very similar?
Not that very far apart, really. Not in my little mind at the time. Both were good ways of being a patriot.
Yeah.
I decided to go to law school instead of seminary. In my second year of law school, I was actually drafted. Mm. So I thought I was safe with a school deferment, but I fell through a loophole in the deferment law, and I was a chicken hawk. I guess I would call it a chicken hawk. I supported killing the commies, as I called them at the time. And I just didn't want to be one of the soldiers that was doing it. I preferred to stay in the safety of graduate school. But then I got stuck, and I had no philosophical or political opposition to the war, so I enlisted in the Air Force for 4 years rather than go into the Army for two. Became an officer. My first 2 years I was had a plus job at Headquarters Air Force in Washington, and then I got my assignment to be a fairly low-level commander of a Air Force Ranger-type unit that was to be trained at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and then immediately sent to Vietnam. So that's what happened, and I had a unit of about 40 men, and our job primarily was to protect air bases from attacks. There I was in Vietnam in the spring of 1969, and I was... kind of strangely given an extra duty, which I didn't even have to do, but it was by the Vietnamese commander, where I was the night security commander. And he asked me to accompany one of his lieutenants to assess the success of bombing missions.
Yeah.
He had heard a rumor that some of the new Vietnamese pilots were going to sabotage their missions, and they were infiltrators from the VC.
Mm.
So I was very naive, and I said, yeah, it was a daytime duty. It was not particularly dangerous. The dangerous time was at night. So I did that, and in 1 week, it turns out that five targets that we were assessing were all inhabited, undefended villages. So I, in that week, saw somewhere between 700 and 900 dead villagers, most of whom were children or women, were doing domestic farming chores during the daytime and were bombed at about 300 foot altitude and it blew napalming. So I was kind of shocked, and I really thought it was a mistake, but then I quickly realized that this was deliberate, intentional policy. This was the way the war was being waged, and I turned against the war.
Yeah.
And I was sent home early after 5 months.
Because of turning against, were you vocally opposing it?
Well, nobody told me why I was sent home early, but I have to conclude that it was because I was no longer a obedient cooperative officer, even though I was carrying out my night security duties with my men.
Yeah.
Really, my adrenaline was still working. We were attacked, while I was there, we were attacked maybe 14 times, and that's with mortars. And then a few zapper probes on the ground, so you kind of had to be alert.
Mm.
But I assume it was because of my attitude. You might say I had an attitude problem. And I was sent home. I had a year left to do in the military, which I served in Louisiana. And there was some discussion of a court martial, but there was never a court martial convened. I got out as a captain and finished law school. Took the bar in Washington, D.C., passed the bar, and soon found that I was not able to or not willing to comply with the protocol of the courtroom. I left law very quickly and just started doing other things in the 70s. I was very anti-war, but I wasn't really wanting to talk about Vietnam, and I did not want to hang out with other Vietnam veterans at the time because I didn't even want to think of myself as a veteran.
Wow, really?
As that may sound.
It just so divorced from it after that experience,
Yeah, I just wanted to get it out of my life. I can't really do that, but I thought I could do it for a while, and I did for a while. And I did a lot of work on prison issues in the 70s with different organizations because I was a law-trained person. And by the end of the decade, I was actually finding myself dairy farming just to get away from everybody as part of my therapy. I lost the dairy farm in a divorce, and then in the 80s, I started studying a lot about Reagan's policies in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And became very concerned about reading news accounts of describing people in those countries as Marxist-Leninists. And I knew that was a code word for basically killing people who were organizing for some kind of justice in their world, in their society. And it was a way to bring the Pavlovian dog, American public, along with those policies. And I knew that was, those were code words for murder.
Well, did that bring back your experience in Vietnam then, the same parallel?
Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, it did. I had a psychotic flashback in 1981 to being in a village in Vietnam, and that at that point I became a Vietnam veteran for sure. And then I had to go to therapy, and I had to go to rap groups and start processing the fact that I myself was a Vietnam veteran, even though many people were shocked to learn that I was a Vietnam veteran because I hadn't been telling a lot of my friends anything about it all through the 70s. I was kind of ashamed of it, really. I mean, not that a lot of other vets necessarily shared that sense of shame, and I certainly didn't know any at the time that did, but then over time I have met other vets that feel similarly to me, and generally we are not in the traditional veterans organizations. In the VFW and the American Legion, but that's okay, different strokes for different folks. So I had to find my own supportive group, later called Veterans for Peace organization. So I did a little more work on prison issues in the 80s, and then I became director of a Veterans Outreach Center in Massachusetts, dealing with PTSD and Agent Orange issues. And by that time, I was really getting really, really upset and concerned about Reagan's wars in Central America to the point that I resigned my position and went to Nicaragua. And that really then changed my life again.
Did you go under any special auspices just by yourself or with a group?
No, I went down to be a student in a Spanish language school up in the mountains of northern Nicaragua. I really wanted to study the war firsthand. And the first week I was there, there were contra-attacks. You know, for your listeners, the Contras were Reagan's terrorists that he had funded and armed to overthrow the Nicaraguan Revolution. It was called the Sandinista Revolution.
Right.
After they had been under the dictatorship of a U.S. sponsored tyrannical rule, Somoza, for about 40 years. So I was very interested in the revolutionary process in Nicaragua. And so there I was in 86, and saw 11 people were killed near where I was living. Mm. I really got then really reconnected with Vietnam in a very visceral way.
Mm-hmm. You were there with the victims, basically,
yeah,
at that time.
Well, I was very close to them and saw their bodies. And I just decided that I wanted to spend my time learning whatever I could about U.S. policy up close with the people who were the victims, and then come back to the United States and educate people about our policies.
Right.
You know, which in some way is still very difficult to do in this society, but nonetheless, I met other veterans who had been down in Nicaragua and Salvador and who wanted to also be politically expressive of our revulsion of U.S. policy and try to convey that notion to other people in the United States. So by the fall of 1986, I and three other veterans went on we went on an open-ended water-only fast on the steps of the Capitol. Mm. It lasted 47 days, and we ended the fast when one of our members was near death. Mm. We had lots of solidarity around the country, finally, after maybe in our fourth and fifth week of fasting. But we were basically fasting as kind of representing the people in Nicaragua and El Salvador who were being killed. And we were kind of their surrogates sitting on the steps of the Capitol, kind of losing weight, which became dramatic after the fourth or fifth week. I mean, just visibly.
Yeah.
How
did the media treat you during that process? Did you get a lot of media?
Very little media.
Yeah.
Very little media. excuse me, very little media overall. But we did finally get on the Phil Donahue show, which was, at that time, a fairly popular TV, if you know the Phil Donahue history. So that brought more national attention to our message. And then a few days after that, one of our members was getting sick, and so we ended the fast after 47 days. Actually, all four of us continued in different ways our activities, and mine was to help organize groups of veterans to go back into Nicaragua's war zones and do both visible observation and monitoring of Contra activities while working on constructive projects such as building schools, building health clinics, and so forth. So that's what I did in all through the winter and spring of 1986-87.
Right.
And then just witnessed continued carnage.
Was it possible to get, you know, proof against what was, I mean, how did you get that information out? How did you manage to disperse that?
Well, that was very difficult. We had pretty good networks with various churches that were interested in the more progressive churches, both Catholic and Protestant, that were equally repulsed by these policies. So they all had newsletters and networks. And then there were Central America Solidarity organizations, of course, that had their own networks and news organs. In terms of the mass media, the major media, very little attention. Occasionally an article here or there.
Yeah.
But not a lot. And so when we came back from having spent a number of weeks and months in the war zones with lots more documentation in the spring of 1987, including the fact that Ben Linder had been murdered. Ben Linder was a Portland, Oregon mechanical engineer working in the war zones of Matagalpa, developing little hydro dams to help campesinos get small amounts of electricity to refrigerate their medicines.
Oh, yeah.
And he was murdered at the end of April. I had met him just 3 weeks before. So in May, I started meeting with other people to go to the site of where the weapons were coming from, that were U.S. weapons that were going to El Salvador and Nicaragua, and that was at the Concord, California Naval Weapons Station.
Oh, yes.
The largest Department of War weapons depot on the West Coast. So by early June, we had started a vigil next to the tracks that carries the munitions from the bunkers to the ships on Sacramento River at Port Chicago, and the trucks that carry the same munitions on a parallel road to the tracks to the same port. And so we were there all summer in 1987. People were getting arrested, blocking trucks and occasionally a train. And I was basically a support person during the summer. But in August, I decided I would embark upon a 40-day water-only fast on the railroad ties between the rails with two other veterans. And so we prepared ourselves for that psychically. We figured we'd probably be in jail.
Yeah.
And we sent a long letter to the base commander explaining exactly what we were going to do, when we were starting it, why we were doing it, what the laws being violated were by the U.S. government, and requesting a meeting with the base commander, and he refused to meet with us, despite repeated requests in the last 15 days prior to September 1st. So then we took our position on September 1st, 87, 1 year after we started the Veterans Fast in 86, and took our positions and expected to be arrested. There are 350 armed Marines at that base, and there was usually local police who were there when trains were moving and protesters were on the tracks. So there was no problem with danger. It was just a matter of being prepared to be arrested and being taken to jail.
Yeah.
And going with the chips fall when you get into that legal process.
Right.
And the speed limit there is 5 miles an hour. Usually the trains are going 3 to 4 miles an hour. They're carrying these explosive munitions. The trains and trucks at Concord Naval Weapons Station only carried munitions. That was their only function.
Yeah.
So all the weapons, all the trains and the trucks had explosive cargo on them headed for various war zones in the world, but many of them were going to Central America.
Yeah.
So then we took our positions on September 1st, and the next thing I knew, I was waking up in a hospital 4 days later.
Whoa.
And with no memory of what happened.
So it literally happened right at the very beginning then. It wasn't...
Very first day of my fast.
Very first day.
Yep.
And
it was always a mystery as to why they did that. And it didn't take us long to find out. But I was in shock, and I could not just fathom how this could have happened.
Yeah.
But we found out.
Where did that come from? Obviously, there must have been orders from somewhere.
Yes, there were orders by the base commander to the... The train crew, there were 3 members of the train crew, 2 spotters who stood on the front of the locomotive, whose job it was to be in radio contact with the engineer, making sure there was nothing on the tracks.
Right.
That day they came to work. They were ordered on that day not to stop the train because they feared it was going to be boarded, that is, hijacked.
by all these unarmed peace activists.
Well, it's only a 3-mile section of track, and again, 350 armed Marines protect the train. And local police were usually present when protesters were on the tracks. We went from June on that year almost every day. So what we found out was that during the fast on the capital steps the year before, the four of us veterans had been identified as potential, not as potential, but had, we had been identified as domestic terrorist suspects under Reagan's new anti-terrorism guidelines. We did not know that, of course. Yeah. While I was in the hospital, the interrogators, investigators did come and start interrogating me with my lawyer present, and they were stressing again and again when I had begun planning to board the train, and which it was just, you know, I just had to shake my head. and then an FBI agent was fired while I was in the hospital. It just happened. He was fired that month after 22 years in the FBI, and he spilled the beans, saying he had refused to investigate us as domestic terrorists because we were nonviolently protesting Reagan's terrorist policies in Central America. And so this is a very unusual FBI agent.
Yeah.
He did lose his job after 22 years, and we became good friends to this day. But that was that helped explain why the train was speeding more than three times the speed limit. So the speed limit being 5 miles an hour, the FBI looked at the one video footage of the train, which was taken by a friend of mine who was there to document our arrests.
Yeah, I remember seeing that film. Yeah,
and said it was going 17 miles an hour and still accelerating at the point of impact.
Wow.
Again, it was a major crime that was committed against us on the tracks. One of the other veterans dove to the left at the last minute, and the other vet jumped straight up and grabbed the cowcatcher railing that was on above the platform of the cowcatcher where the two spotters were standing.
Yeah,
and then he jumped, then quickly jumped off the train. And was one of the first persons to my body after the whole train went over and continued going for another 400 feet.
They
stopped and was surrounded by armed Marines.
Right, and so your mind is literally blacked out there just before.
Correct.
I mean, the train was coming, and then.
Well, I don't even remember the train coming.
Wow.
I remember being at the tracks waiting to see the first train. Before we took our positions on the tracks. And I don't remember actually taking my position with the other two veterans. I don't remember the train coming, and I remember nothing until I woke up in the hospital on about September 5th, all bandaged up, and I had to have people explain to me what happened. I had no idea what happened. I was shocked.
Wow. Well, and what a thing to wake up to, losing your legs. I mean,
I also had a big hole in my skull. I had a huge hole from where my piece of my cranium was completely knocked loose and driven into my right frontal lobe. So I had brain damage as well. And it wasn't clear for a while how functional I would be because of the physical damage to the brain. But it turned out that I retained most of my cognitive functioning after doing a series of tests. And just being able to converse with people in my hospital room was overjoyous to my family that was there. Because they had no idea what I would be like when I started, you know, when I came out of my unconscious state.
And
then I just continued, after I healed from that, I just continued doing the same thing I've always done. Just continued my activism.
But that healing must have taken quite a time, surely?
Physically, it took me a good 2 or 3 months. I was in the hospital 28 days. And I had all my right ribs were cracked and my right shoulder was broken and my right wrist was broken and my right elbow was broken and my left elbow was broken and my right kidney was damaged and my left ear had been cut off and sewn back on, luckily. I had a lot of damage inside my mouth. I was just kind of amazed at how I could have survived.
Yeah, really?
Going completely under the locomotive. I wasn't straddling the tracks. I was sitting in a lotus position in front of the train. And only in the last second or two did my autonomic nervous system, my adrenaline, go into motion to try to get me off the tracks, because I just never cognitively couldn't imagine them doing what they were doing. So
right.
I was trying to get off the last second by looking at all the photographs, but that would have been the adrenaline sending the blood to the muscles and rather than to the brain, which is what happens when the adrenaline is secreted in emergency situations, and so it basically enables you to do kind of magical feats physically to avoid danger at the last second. But it was too late in my case.
Yeah. Now, going back to the discovering what happened, because it's military, was it very hard to get information apart from the FBI guy because of, through the Freedom of Information Act or things like that?
Well, we were in court for 3 years, so we were getting a lot of information through the subpoena process. And, we got the documentation of the orders to the train crew not to stop. We got the copy of the cables that the commander sent to Washington before September 1st, announcing that they did not expect any rail traffic to be seriously interrupted, because even though the cable acknowledged that we would not move for approaching traffic, that we would be safely removed by local police. That was the cable that was sent to headquarters, Washington, just the day before September 1st. So we always tried to figure out or tried to find whether the order came from above the base commander.
Right.
And we were not able to firmly establish the next level of the chain of command involved. But there were the base commander and three levels of command down to the train crew. And they were all certainly involved in the decision to run the train.
Right. Exactly. That's a direct line, so to speak. The other veterans who were with you on that day, what's happened to them since then? Do you know?
Well, there were about 40 to 50 people there that day, and about a dozen of them were veterans. And some of them remain traumatized even from that day, but they're all involved in one way or another in different peace and justice activities. I've lost track of most of them. But there's at least three that I know of that are still very active. Once you see the lies, it's pretty hard to continue to ignore them.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously now since then, you've, as you were saying, you have continued your activism. What areas have you been working in?
Well, I continued going to Latin America a lot. I continued going to Nicaragua and El Salvador. I met with the guerrillas in El Salvador in '88. I continued going into South America, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, Argentina, Panama, and again, many trips to Nicaragua and El Salvador. And then after the Zapatista Revolution in Chiapas, Mexico, in January 1994, I've spent a lot of time in Chiapas studying the Zapatista Revolution, and then I also have spent a lot of time in Korea, both North and South Korea, studying the whole history of U.S. intervention that actually directly caused the Korean War, despite the history that says otherwise. So I'm writing a book on that. I had to finish my memoirs first, which I've just finished, as you know, Blood on the Tracks.
We want to talk about that, yes.
So, but I will now resume my writing the book on the history of of U.S. intervention in Korea. That's another terribly tragic story that hardly anybody knows about. And I've been over there 8 times doing my research. Mm. And also I've been in North Korea doing a lot of research, and that's been very interesting.
Yeah, how open are they, to you?
Well, not that open, but because of my work in Korea and my political attitudes, I've been more welcome there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm more trusted as a nut to being a spy or something, whatever. But it's not a particularly open society. But also, I understand the history of how Korea, north of the 38th parallel, and how they've been isolated all these years with nobody understanding what happened to them in 1945 when the U.S. came in.
Mm.
So I don't make judgments on them. I just try to tell the truth about what my country's done.
Yeah.
And how it's affected other people and how it's affected the Koreans. But that's a story that I have to finish.
Well, yeah, let's get back to your new book, your autobiography, Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. How long did that take you to? When did you start it?
And, I started writing that in 2002. And it took me really 8 years to write the memoirs to the point where I was ready to submit it to publishers. And then when I started submitting the manuscript to publishers under the working title of Going AWOL from the American Way of Life, that was my working title.
Okay.
It was rejected by 33 publishers, so I was not sure it was ever going to get published. And I was actually being kind of an insecure person anyways, I was thinking, okay, maybe it's not a very good read, and I'll just self-publish a couple hundred copies and give them to my friends or something.
Yeah.
And then finally a publisher, PM Press, P as in printed and M as in matter, Press in Oakland, agreed to publish it pretty much the way I wanted it. I wanted a 500-page book that had a lot of historical information that was all footnoted and referenced.
Mm-hmm.
It has a complete index along with over 500 endnotes and a very long recommended reading list.
Mm-hmm.
And 112 photographs on photo paper.
Mm.
So it makes it for a long book, but it's I wanted it to be interesting to readers who were interested both in my own life story and how I had to study history and anthropology and evolutionary biology to understand how this journey works in the Western world and the modern world, and how it departs from our, perhaps at least, how it departs from our archetypal human characteristics of empathy, cooperation, mutual respect, and equity or fairness, and how it was that it was so easy for me to follow an order to do something so absurd as to go 9,000 miles across the ocean to participate in destroying other people's villages. I mean, that is really...
Yeah.
That became a question that I just thought was an astounding question of how it's so easy. And it is easy. People do it all the time. And
right.
They've been doing it all the time throughout many centuries, depending on which empire you're in. But I still found, in my case, it to be a preposterous thing to do. And so I had to study the history of obedience versus disobedience and the history of vertical power structures versus horizontal power structures. I had to study the psychology of dignity versus longevity.
Hmm.
This was all part of my research to understand my own journey.
Right.
And so it's all, I had to bring in a lot of other quote-unquote historical and academic material that I could cite to support my sense of what was happening to me, why it was so easy to do something so criminal, and how it is that epiphanies work and how change works,
mm-hmm.
and how consciousness can blossom with the death of old paradigms,
right.
Of which I was very well conditioned into. I was actually a very successful young man in terms of being a good student and being a good athlete and being a good churchman.
Yeah.
So I was basically grooming myself to be you know, just a happily successful person in the United States. So, and a lot of, you know, it was a good story, and I wasn't looking to change it, but things happen. And,
things happen.
Yeah. Well, if you don't have history, you don't have any way to assess the veracity or the truth of whatever currently is being stated. If you just don't have any frame of reference with which to compare today with the past, then you're just kind of lost to follow with whatever they're saying in the moment,
right,
without any knowledge of, well, that doesn't make any sense. What do you mean? So, you know, Orwell said, those who control the present control the past. Those who control the past control the future, because those who control the past do it by eradicating memory.
Exactly, and eradicating history from schools.
Exactly.
It's just going right along with that, isn't it?
Yep, yep. And so I became a real history buff because I knew, even with a master's degree in Vietnam, when I was in Vietnam, I knew I was really dumbed down. And I didn't like the feeling that I had been abused like that, but I was now, I was determined not to be abused like that again.
Yeah. And now, obviously, in 2002 you started it. Was that in response to 9/11, the year before?
No, it really wasn't. It was because I had been delaying writing the book for probably 10 years.
Mm.
And I finally just got enough gumption to say, I really got to start getting up in the morning and devoting so many hours a day to writing my memoirs.
Yeah.
And I don't think 9/11 had anything to do with that starting point. I mean, maybe it did subconsciously, but not consciously. Basically, I thought 9/11 was whatever, however it happened, whether it was concocted or whether it was totally created by our own government or allowed to happen. I thought that what happened was an opportunity for people in this country to know to feel what it's like to be on this end of something pretty terrible, because this is what we've done to people all over the world for a long time. And I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to learn some humility and learn some empathy for other people. Nope. We just became more self-centered, more narcissistic.
But obviously the parallels of Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya must just be ringing your head now.
I have to do a lot of extra meditational breathing just to get myself through the days. But I have to also put it in the context of, since our origins as a republic, we have invaded militarily almost 600 times in over 100 countries. And we, since World War II, have covertly intervened in over 100 countries thousands of times. And since World War II, we've bombed 28 countries. So this is our pattern as an imperial nation, to make sure we get what we want, when we want it, for the price we want to pay, and which is usually very little. And many other people, human beings and cultures and the earth itself, suffer as a result. And we love to kind of tout our exceptional society, which can only successfully be touted by absolutely being denial about all the egregious consequences that are actually required to maintain this sense of kind of a being in a bubble. We're leaving the age of entitlement, which has been enabled by plunder. Entitlement for maybe 20% of the world's population, mostly Eurocentric population. And we're now entering the era of consequences. And it's like the chickens coming home to roost.
How do you see that playing out over, say, the next 5 years? What with the Middle East, what's happening there, and us pulling out, theoretically, out of Iraq and Afghanistan?
We'll never pull out of Iraq. We may rhetorically say we're pulling out, but we will never be pulling out of Iraq. I'm not a very good predictor of what's going to happen. All I know is that our Western model is so totally unsustainable, ecologically, economically, socially, politically, psychologically. It's been built on this incredible exploitation and plunder. Always justified by noble-sounding rhetoric and rationalizations. And it's and what's not sustainable is not sustainable. It's just a matter of time before it falls. And we know that our dollar is weak. It could fall at any time.
Mm-hmm.
We know that our lifestyle is putting huge amounts of carbon molecules in the air that could lead to something as bad as nuclear winter. Mm-hmm. And we know that we're running out of everything.
Yep.
Water, oil, copper, selenium, even coal is not nearly the lifespan that some people say, or natural gas. And all the extraction processes themselves are terribly exploitive.
Right.
So there is one thing left for us to realize, and that is our survival requires radical downsizing of our consumptive lives to more simple lives living in cooperation with local community people. Picking up where we left off in the early Neolithic villages, in the very early period after the Ice Age, and perhaps back into the Paleolithic period even. I mean, our species developed our basic body types and our basic character traits around survival, which was dependent upon cooperation in small groups.
Good point.
We can't live without that.
Right, and to that end, you have done you've changed your lifestyle directly, haven't you?
I have. And there's a lot more to go. I mean, there's a lot more to do. I'm promoting my book so far by hand cycling with my arms from Portland to San Francisco, and I'm almost in San Francisco. I'll be there day after tomorrow. And I just wanted to promote the book by moving my body and small amount of weight that my accompanying cyclist is carrying on a bike trailer without burning fossil fuels. I wanted to demonstrate that a 70-year-old man who is a double amputee actually can move. I can actually move myself from town to town and enjoy every bit of the way and promote my book when I get to the venues. And I'm not only promoting book, I'm promoting transportation by cycle as policy, opposed to transportation by burning fossil fuels in a car.
Excellent. What a fabulous idea. And how has it been physically for you, and what's been the toughest bit of this trip so far?
Well, the toughest day was when we were cycling south of Garberville towards Laytonville, and it was 100 degrees by noon.
Ooh.
And we do leave at 6 or 6:30 in the morning to try to get all our cycling in before it gets hotter. But on that day, we had been up four long mountains, and I just can't make more than about 3 miles an hour on those mountains.
Yeah.
And there were just too many of them. And I got stuck on our 37th mile. I usually can do 45 to 50 miles okay with my arms.
Wow.
But on this day, I was at mile 37. We still had 12 miles to go, and it was really hot. I had gone through all of my 120 ounces of water. I always carry 120 ounces when I start off in the morning. I ran out of my energy bars, and I was running out of energy, and it was high noon, and we were on a section of Highway 101 where there was no shade. And so I actually had to stop and figure out what I was going to do, and I finally convinced myself and my cycling companion, who has been with me all the way, to call for help. And we had somebody in Laytonville who was waiting for us, and we actually called that person. And we had never done that before on the trip. But the person, we never had had this kind of a problem up to that day. And so our very gracious host who was waiting for us in Laytonville happened to have a pickup truck, and he came and picked up our cycles, including the wagon, the bike trailer, and us, and took us to his place in Laytonville. And so that was a rough day. I mean, I thought maybe I had suffered a heat stroke, but I had not.
Wow.
It was just heat exhaustion. And I was able to cycle the next day, but after a good night's rest. So that was a tough day, and It's always kind of hairy being in 101, especially in California, with all the trucks going by, and in some places there's not much of a shoulder.
Right.
And my hand cycle is a three-wheeled recumbent, so I need about at least 32, 34 inches of width. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my left rear tire, it's two-wheeled on the back and one on the front. Sometimes my left tire was in the lane of traffic because there wasn't enough shoulder space. And those trucks, sometimes I felt like they were going by my left elbow as I was cranking. My hand cycle was going by my elbow at about 12 to 15 inches. And it's like, that's pretty close.
Yeah. Definitely better you than me.
A lot of them are log trucks, these big log trucks carrying, you know, these redwoods. Yeah. They're still cutting these redwood trees.
Right.
And, I mean, I saw hundreds of them.
Yeah. Still going. And how has been your reception coming down through and speaking to people through this
trip? Well,
it's
been varied. We started in Portland on June 24th. And started cycling the next morning, June 25th, and we've been at, I think, about 14 venues now, and it's varied from venue to venue. One venue, we had nobody show up, but most of the venues, and another venue, only three showed up, but usually there's somewhere between 15 and 100. It just varies on the venue and how well they publicized it. And last night, I was in Walnut Creek, and there was probably about 60 people there, and at least half of them bought books.
Oh, fabulous!
Which I signed, and Ben Ellsberg wrote the introduction, a very beautiful introduction for those of people who remember Dan Ellsberg. I mean, actually, people under 50 don't seem to remember Dan Ellsberg's name. I'm kind of shocked about how little people know of U.S. history, including recent history.
It does shock me. It is bad. But no, that's a great person to have on the introduction, and gives you great weight to the book.
Yeah, and I got 23 great endorsements from people, including Noam Chomsky. So everybody seems to like it so far. I'm sure I'll get somebody that you know, gives me a good constructive hit, saying that it didn't cite something properly, or the themes are not great, or something. But my basic theme in the whole book is the Western American way of life is totally pathological, and as human beings, we need to liberate ourselves from it.
Mm-hmm. Good message. It's something here in Sonoma County, in the West County, especially where you are now, that's something we work on a lot.
Oh, that's good.
We are.
And another theme is dignity trumps longevity. Hmm. Another theme is horizontal preempts the vertical, if you want to remain humane and human. Mm-hmm. Small horizontal units, basically small, thousands of communities operating without authority coming from above. But learning to cooperate as our aged ancestors learned how to survive through cooperation and empathy, basically. We cannot live without empathy. That's what ties us all together.
Exactly.
Suffering to one, I feel the suffering. Joy to one, I feel the joy. That is real solidarity.
Yeah, very true. Now, when you reach the Bay Area, San Francisco, what are your plans there and after that?
Well, I'll be in San Rafael Friday night. No. Yeah, Friday night. And then Saturday, I'll be in San Francisco on the 16th, 17th, and 18th. I'll be at the First Unitarian Church on Sunday, the First Unitarian Church at 12:30 in San Francisco. And then the next day, Monday, I'll be at the Berkeley Unitarian Fellowship in the evening. And then I go somewhere in there. I go to San Jose. And then I go to Santa Cruz, and then Monterey, and then I take Amtrak back to Portland, if they'll allow my hand cycle on the train, and then take a couple days off, and then go take the train again to just south of Seattle and cycle back to Portland, at the end of July and early August in time for the Veterans for Peace Convention, which starts August 3rd in Portland. I will have cycled 800 miles.
Oh, my goodness. That is incredible. Well, Brian, thank you so much for your time and for giving us such a detailed description of your life and where you're going. And I think it's great. Keep doing it. We need so many more people like you to show the way.
Well, I'm just kind of walking the talk the best I can, and you know, I don't make any pretenses about it. It's just the way it is, and if it can motivate other people, great. I'll still keep doing it.
Yep.
No matter what happens.
Good, and I'll get this book, and I'm looking forward to the North and South Korea book. That sounds very interesting.
Yep, I'm looking forward to finishing it.
Yep. Well, great. All the best on your trip.
Okay.
And thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.